today's defense budget, depending on how you want to calculate things as being part of defense, is somewhere between $680 billion and $1.2 trillion a year. If you include the nuclear weapons in the Energy Department, which should be included in any calculation of defense, if you include Veterans Administration, you include defense-related activities in the State Department, Homeland Security is defense-related, you can get yourself up to $1 to $1.2 trillion. And, you know, we're fighting two relatively small wars, in Afghanistan and Iraq. The wars are intense for the people who are involved in the fighting. I don't want to create a misleading impression there. In fact, it's probably some of the toughest combat we've ever had in the history of the nation. But in terms of overall commitment and in terms of forces committed, in terms of operating tempos, these wars are tiny. We fly probably something on the order of 1,000 sorties a month in Afghanistan and Iraq combined, maybe a little bit more, maybe between 1,000 and 2,000 sorties. We flew over 1,000 sorties a day in Vietnam. That just gives you an idea. Even though these wars are relatively small in terms of total commitment of forces, our defense budget today is more than it was at any time since the end of World War II, after you remove the effects of inflation. In other words, we could take out 65 years of the cumulative effects of inflation, and it's still higher than the peak spending of the Vietnam War in constant dollars or the peak spending of the Korean War. And in fact, we're now in the second most expensive war in the U.S. history. They've even made some estimates of the Civil War. You know, and of course they're kind of flaky, but it appears that we're spending more than we spent in the Civil War. Constant dollars.
So are we not getting enough bang for our defense buck, so to speak?
Well, that's my view, and I've done a lot of work to show that. And it's a very the story about how we've done this is complicated, but it's very well documented. And in fact, if you read the book The Pentagon Labyrinth, you'll find a series of footnotes in my chapter, and in particularly in my chapter and Pierre Spray's chapter and Tom Christie's chapter. That shows that we have information going back to the 80s, really the late 70s. The information was published in the 80s, showing that these problems existed. So this is nothing new. And the important thing to understand is we've got a Navy today, for example, that is roughly one third the size of what it was during Vietnam. Got less than 300 ships. We got a tactical air force, fighters, bombers that probably is a little bit more than one-third, between one-third and 40% the size of what it was in Vietnam. And the Army is about the same size, of, you know, the same percentage, is about 30 to 40% of what it was in Vietnam. And remember, when we fought in Vietnam, not only were we fighting the war in Vietnam, but we had probably close to 500,000 troops forward deployed in Europe and other parts of East Asia as part of the Cold War. We had thousands of nuclear warheads on alert in missile silos and on submarines, and we had hundreds of bombers in the air on alert, you know, to protect us against the Cold War. And we maintained a huge rotation base at home, you know, to keep all those forces going on. It's roughly 1 to 3. So, you know, when you look at what we have today compared to what we had just as recently as 1968, 1969, it's absolutely mind-boggling how we have gotten into this situation where we're spending more than we did.
Secretary Gates has been fairly frank about saying, hold on, we need to change the way that we're doing things. Is what he's done, does he have the right ideas in mind?
He hasn't done anything, in my opinion, and that's one reason why I agreed to write the introduction to this book. If you read my introductory chapter, I try to give you, the reader, a general sense and also some links to source data that's on the Internet that can explain my general sense of what the problem is. And then the last section of that article is about the recently completed Quadrennial Defense Review, which was done in it was published last March, I believe.
Right. Yep.
and a year ago, and that was Obama's first real imprint on, you know, his Defense Department for the reasons that I explain in the book. And that Quadrennial Defense Review didn't come close to dealing with the real problems we're facing. In fact, it's a complete joke. You know, so Gates may, you know, he can talk the talk, but he ain't walking the walk.
It seems like this is a particularly difficult time to be, well, it's been increasingly difficult because the types of wars that you face are just so varied. You have everything from the types of wars that we're facing in the Middle East, and even that, those are fairly different to the potential of facing off against China. It feels like you have to prepare for everything these days.
I don't buy that at all. Essentially, people are trying to make the Chinese threat into something that requires, that justifies its defense budget. The Chinese are spending roughly $90 billion a year on defense. We're spending a minimum of 680 a year on defense, you know, if you include the two wars. If you take out the wars, it's a minimum of about 530, 540. So we're spending at least five or six times as much as the Chinese. So to say that, we have to spend more to deal with these things, I think is complete hogwash. First of all, the Chinese have trouble getting out of China. And if we haven't learned now to stay out of wars in Asia, you know, you really have to ask if we've got our heads screwed on. What is the real threat posed by China? It hasn't really been well defined. If you think about the situation that we're in, when the Cold War ended in 1990, it ended, you know, as far as the Pentagon was concerned, suddenly without warning. So what did we do? We immediately put programs like the F-22, the F-18EF, the new submarine into engineering and manufacturing development, basically so we could spread the subcontracts around the congressional districts for the reasons I've explained in both in my introduction and in the footnotes, the sources in the footnotes, to basically lock the country into them. The budget naturally came down with the end of the Cold War. People said it was a peace dividend, but that's absurd. It went down to a low Cold War level. And meanwhile, we got the system pregnant. And in fact, I wrote an article in 1996, I believe, called the Defense Budget Time Bomb, which is also footnoted in there and can be downloaded from the Internet, that explained how the budget was going to explode in the latter part of the 1990s and thereafter. We basically created the crisis with malice aforethought, and we have the documents to prove it now, and all a person has to do is go in there and take the time to read them. Put simply, when we put the F-22 and the F-18EF into engineering and manufacturing development, we had no plan to modernize the bulk of our forces in the out years. That meant that the age of the force was going to go up to a point where it would finally cause a force structure shrinkage. That's exactly what happened. The Clinton administration comes in, and they got snookered into starting a joint strike fighter to fill the vacuum, which ended up being the biggest defense program in the history of the Pentagon. You know, it's going to be $200 to $300, maybe more, $1 billion a year. And if you look at it, it's designed according to the specifications of things we used to design to fight the Cold War, even though it was started after the Cold War. It would have made a lot more sense at that time if we behaved like a sensible planner. What was the single most important thing from a planner's perspective that happened at the end of the Cold War? Basically, our uncertainty about the future went up. We became much more uncertain about what was going to happen. How did we respond to that? We responded to that by taking actions that in effect locked us onto a long-term evolutionary pathway. In other words, instead of making ourselves more flexible to deal with the unpredictable nature of the future, which had just gotten much more unpredictable, we acted as if we could predict it more accurately. You know, it's insane. But it's insane if you think of it as defining a system that's responding to external threats. If you think of it as a system that is designed to shovel money through the military-industrial congressional complex, it made perfect sense, because the biggest uncertainty coming out of the end of the Cold War was the threat to the budget. And the key to reducing that threat was to get the system pregnant, essentially get the cows out of the barn before the barn door closed. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, 911 came along, and that sort of iced the cake. We certainly didn't need things like F-22s and F-18EFs and, you know, new attack submarines and new Aegis missile cruisers or new missile defense systems to deal with 911.
As we get into this area where money much tighter all the way around, even for DOD, is this an opportunity to refocus the DOD's future, how it spends its money?
Well, it should be. We had a better opportunity in 1990, and now we're going to have to pay the piper. Essentially, what the situation is, right now, the Defense Department, if you just look at it from a management standpoint, it has a modernization program that cannot modernize the force. If we execute our modernization system perfectly and we get all the budget increases that the Pentagon expected to get in the future as recently as last year, we cannot buy enough new weapons soon enough to prevent the force from aging and getting much older. And it's already at the oldest time since the end of the equipment's already the oldest it has been on average since the end of World War II. So we got a modernization program that can't modernize the force. Killing a few programs isn't going to change that. You need a major structural revamp. We also have a problem of decreasing force readiness, which is caused by a combination of the ongoing wars, which is wearing out the equipment and wearing out our troops, because we don't have enough troops to support these endless wars on a rotation basis. You know, so they're redeploying and redeploying. We're having problems with post-traumatic stress syndrome and things like that. We're getting lots of combat injuries, really bad injuries, because our medical care has improved a lot. And, you know, people, we're going to be living with the consequences of these injuries for the next 30 to 40 to 50 years. And we also have, they're cutting back on training because the operations and maintenance budget is growing, because the equipment is not only getting older, but it has become much more expensive. So you have two effects on increasing operating costs. Number one, the increasing age of the equipment, which is then compounded by the increasing complexity of the commitment of the equipment. It multiplies itself. We bought this stuff under promises where they said it'd be cheaper to operate, and of course that's not the case. I did a study back in the 1970s that showed that. And we had a huge congressional hearing in 1983, landing me on the cover of Time magazine, that said that. And, you know, it just got ignored. And so these problems have been building up for a long time. And that gets us to the third problem in resource management, which I get at in detail, well, not in real detail, but I discuss in the last part of my introduction, and that is the bookkeeping shambles. Our accounting system is completely corrupted, and it's unauditable. So if we reduce the budget, you know, the Pentagon comes back and says, well, you can't reduce the budget because you're going to kill all these things. They don't have a clue. We don't have a clue what things cost because the accounting system is a mess. So the bottom line is we do not have the information to put together a coherent pathway to get ourselves out of this mess. So job one is to clean up the accounting system. Now, this is not a new problem. I have written about this problem since 1983, you know, and it's come to a head just like all of us said it was going to come to a head. The people in that book have been, you know, several of us that wrote in that book have been hollering about this problem for 20 to 30 years, you know, and what has happened is the system at the, you know, the 911 just put such a boost into the system. We got ourselves involved in these wars that we can't figure out how to get out of, and it's just brought everything to a head. You know, it's like a cancer metastasizing. So, you know, what we have to do, one other point. I talked about the modernization program that can't modernize the force, the rising cost of low readiness, and its effect on declining readiness, and the accounting shambles. The accounting shambles basically, you can think of it as the grease that keeps those other two things in place. But what that has done is created an inwardly focused bureaucratic machine, money spending machine, that pumps money, you know, through the military industrial congressional complex, and it has made its internal dynamics completely disconnected from the external threats. The threats are just sort of floating out there like a gas, and we're not responding to them. And, of course, the proof of the pudding is that look at all the trouble they had to do to get the DOD to buy MRAPs. And I'm not even sure an MRAP's a good vehicle, but that's beside the point. You know, it was something that they needed in Afghanistan or thought they needed. And, you know, it took a long time to get the Pentagon conditioned to buy that thing while it was fighting a war. We still have a terrible infantry rifle in the war, the M4. It's the M6. It's not as good as the M16. And the M16 was a disaster in Vietnam. You know, the AK-47 is a good gun. You know, and that's what the guerrillas are carrying. So we have a system that is basically operating on its own internal dynamics. It's a political economy. And essentially, this political economy has evolved over the period between 1945 and 1990 during the Cold War. And you can sort of think of it as an evolution, a cultural evolution in a Darwinian sense. We basically developed bureaucratic techniques to squeeze money out of the system. And we had an economy that was somewhat isolated from the larger economy. You know, to be sure, we bought things. We bought food. We bought some spare parts from the larger economy. But a lot of the stuff was internally driven. And it's by the relationship between the contractors, the Pentagon, and the Congress. And so we evolved these management practices that have literally created a defense industrial base that's dysfunctional, which I explain in one of the footnotes in my article. These companies cannot produce commercial products. They may be part of other companies that produce commercial products, but the Lockheed Fort Worth factory that produces F-16s and F-22s cannot convert over to producing commercial products because they've learned these management skills that benefit them in that political economy. And that's why the defense industry did not try to convert to civilian production after the Cold War ended. And instead, they decided to go on a Pac-Man thing and consolidate themselves to deal with what was temporarily a shrinking market while planting the seeds for an expanded market in the future, which they then entered with increased oligopolistic power. It's in the Pentagon, we call it a self-licking ice cream cone.